Good morning. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQD 90.7 FM, and streaming live at ksqd.org. This is In the Garden, your Saturday morning garden show with Joe Truscott and me, Stephen E. Pop.
Hello, everybody. Good morning.
In this show, we bring you all sorts of interesting people with expertise in a broad range of garden and horticulture and agriculture, and this morning is no exception. We are privileged to have with us here today farm advisor, irrigation and water resources specialist Michael Kahn. He is an irrigation and water resource advisor for the University of California Cooperative Extension and serves the Central Coast counties of Monterey, San Benito, and Santa Cruz. He received his BS degree in soil and water service from UC Davis and a master's and PhD degrees from Cornell University. He's worked for the UC Cooperative Extension since 1995, first as a vegetable and row crop advisor in the Sacramento Valley, and since 2001 in his current position. His research and extension activities are focused in the areas of irrigation technology, water management of vegetable and horticultural crops, protection of water quality and food safety. He led the development of CropManage, an online decision support tool for water and nutrient management of vegetables in 2011, which is now being adopted for berry, tree, and forage crops. We'll have to talk about forage crops. Michael Kahn, welcome to the studio. Say good morning to our listeners.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for the invitation to be here today.
Words out on the street that he's a really cool guy, so we're lucky to have caught him.
So that bio was quite a mouthful there, Michael. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you really do.
That could be a long story.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I got interested in plants in high school, in fact. I think it started out with my dad having me mow the lawn. He was a manager. He would have me do a lot of the yard work.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. But I liked it.
And where was that?
That was in the East Bay.
Oh, well, no kidding. Yeah, you're a California boy.
Mostly.
Yeah.
I grew up in California since age 11 or 12.
Okay.
Yeah.
Born on the East Coast. Yeah.
Okay. Where on the East Coast?
Connecticut.
Oh, my goodness.
We're doing Connecticut, New Jersey. Then we moved to this place called California in the 70s.
Yeah. There you go.
We had no idea what we were getting into.
A little culture shock, perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And we bought a house right near the base of Mount Diablo in East Bay in Clayton.
Uh-huh.
And spent a lot of time hiking all over the mountains there.
Yeah.
I was probably like the only one. with my friends doing that, but I loved it. Uh-huh. So I was thinking, I think I'm an outdoor type of person. And so when I went to UC Davis, well, actually, before I went to UC Davis, I was thinking, what am I going to study?
Yeah.
So I just looked through the Berkeley catalog because my brother went there. Actually, my mother went back to school and finished her degree there.
Cool.
And I saw this major, soil science.
Uh-huh.
Okay, what do you study there? And it was a little bit of everything. Geology, biology.
It wasn't just dirt?
Yeah, it wasn't just dirt.
Okay.
And I thought, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So then I talked to my high school counselor. You know, what should I do here? Should I go to Berkeley? And she said, no, you want to go to Davis. Because Davis is a good ag school. So I saw they had a major called soil and water science. So soil and water. So I thought, okay, I'll go there. It was a small school back then, and easy to get into.
Yeah.
So no problem. I went there. I was made fun of in the dorms. What are you studying? You know, everyone's ag econ.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Poli sci.
Uh-huh.
Soil and water science. What are you going to do? Make mud pies.
yeah. There you go. So the job or the degree that you ended up with, is that the same as being a hydrologist? Is there a comparison difference there between being a hydrologist and a soil and water person?
there is a difference because a hydrologist is much more an engineer.
And
I'm much more in the soil, water, plant continuum. So plant physiology, understanding physical properties of soil, chemical properties of soil, fertility, and then how water moves through it.
Right.
So the water, so plant-soil-water relations. Where a hydrologist is goes much further below the soil, you know, into the what we call the vadozone and the hydrology and the aquifers.
The aquifers. Yeah, I remember in the U.S. Forest Service when I worked for them, our hydrologists, I'd always see them standing out in the middle of a creek or something with a, you know, a little drop meter, a thermometer, and how fast is the creek moving. And I always kind of ask myself, now, how did these guys get that job? And I'm out here doing what I'm doing. Well, anyway. Okay, so there is a distinct difference. Tell us some more about how you ended up getting into the cooperative extension with this degree.
Yeah, so, you know, as you mentioned, I did go to Cornell for a PhD. I had no agricultural background, you know, from my family. So,
and for those who might not know, Cornell is a great school for ag and plant sciences and all related things.
I think it's the only Ivy League school that actually has an ag department. I would think so.
Yeah, but it's I was in the what they call the public part of the school, so it was great because I could take classes in the private part, which was very pricey. But the great thing about an ag major is when you go to grad school, you pretty much have your tuition paid for, usually, you know, because you're a research assistant.
They need you.
They need you. And so, it was a free education. Got to go to Cornell. And then, you know, they oriented me towards agronomy. I was in the agronomy department. From there.
Describe what an agronomist is.
Well, an agronomist is sort of you know, a person who would specialize in growing all sorts of agronomic crops, you know, everything from corn, soybean. But they could work like with horticultural crops, too, in the field, basically field crops.
Okay, but primarily those that are of some economic value or in that aspect.
And they work on all aspects of growing crops from fertility, water management, pest management, you know, insect pests and disease pests.
So it sounds like these fields are overlapping and integrated with one another in order that they can, you know, correspond together.
Right. I would say so. Even though I have an agronomy background from Cornell. I can work in horticultural crops. And there's, when I was in the Sacramento Valley, I specialized in vegetables, but I worked in irrigation too. And then when there was a opportunity to work in, as you know, full-time irrigation, I came to the Central Coast.
Okay. Would you say that California is part of the country where having the soil water management field plays a bigger role than in other parts of the country in terms of agriculture predominantly or specifically?
Well, the main, I would say anywhere where you have to irrigate crops, it's definitely quite useful, but it's useful in all areas because we'll have, say, on the East Coast, where you have a lot of rain-fed agriculture, you want to, you often have periods of drought, even though you do get rain. And so it's very important to understand how to get most of that moisture to hold in your soil. So it's available for the crop when it isn't raining.
Right. So it doesn't run off.
Doesn't run off. And there's often,
Yeah, I mean, the soils here in California, I know a lot of people who try to grow on the sandy soil, and you probably have a whole sort of lecture on what to do, what to do if your soil is, you know, if your water just keeps washing off. How do you keep it going? But anyway, you were talking about the water side of your business as it related to plants. I mean, are you telling or advising growers how much water they should be using and when they should be using it? I mean, describe what your job is like.
Yeah. A lot of my job is research and figuring out really how much water does a lettuce crop need to grow optimally.
Yeah,
and get the optimal yield and quality.
And when does it need it?
Yeah, and when does it sort of, you got to apply it when the crop needs it and not too much, hopefully. Mm-hmm. Because one of the concerns we have is, of course, overuse of water, but these same crops use a lot of nitrogen fertilizer.
Sure.
So we're trying to protect the groundwater from nitrate contamination. And if you overapply when the crop doesn't need the water, a lot of that water percolates below the root zone, and anything soluble in the soil goes with it. Yeah. Nitrate, form of nitrogen, is very soluble. And so we've put a lot of effort on helping growers manage both nitrogen and water to sort of optimize both.
Yeah, and then obviously those nitrates end up in the aquifer, and then you have a situation like I have on my home well where the nitrate levels are too high for the county's safety guidelines for consumption, so we're on bottled water. I imagine then not only the research that you're doing in terms of what is the optimal amount of water to give a particular crop, but also what is the optimal delivery system, whether that's a drip tape or, well, you can talk about those things.
Yeah, I work with all types of irrigation technologies, and there's a lot of drip used in this area.
And what crops would use drip tape?
Use drip tape on what we call row crops, so vegetables. All these vegetable crops, we can grow them with drip. We usually start them with sprinklers, and you'll see sprinklers going on bare soil like you drive through Watsonville
There's pipes.
The mobile pipe setups.
Yeah, guys hauling those are all over the field, and each row has another pipe, and they're connected. And that's what they're doing at the beginning of the growing season?
Yeah. Now, they can continue with sprinklers through the entire crop cycle, but more and more growers switch to drip. After they get the crop established, they do maybe their initial cultivation, thinning of the crop, and then afterwards they bring in the drip tape. And that works very nice for like the lettuce crops because we're not putting overhead water on it.
Right.
So we have less disease issues.
Right. Yeah. Especially something like strawberries.
I was just going to say.
And all those other things crop up with too much overhead water.
So where would the drip tape be? Because we all drive by these fields and we see the plastic mounds and the strawberries growing on it. But where would the drip tape be? In the gully or up into the plant?
Yeah. So with strawberries, they put the drip tape underneath the plastic mulch that you'll see. And it's...
So it's the first thing to go down on the bed.
Yeah, so
they form
the beds.
Oh, no kidding.
And the tape goes in. Then they'll put plastic mulch. They make holes in the mulch and put the transplants in. This is all happening in November. Then for strawberries, often they're actually establishing those crops with the drip tape. So if they can get everything ready to run the drip system, then they can just start watering it.
I know that one of the more controversial topics in the past locally here in Monterey and Santa Cruz County has been the use of methyl bromide for soil sterilization. And that played a pretty huge role in strawberry crops, but other crops as well, even flower crops when I was growing field grown. Now, aren't they using that same drip tape to do chemigation, where they're actually putting some kind of a soil or pathogen inhibitor through that tape prior to planting? Is that still the case, or have they gone free?
Well, that method is used. It is not as popular as we would hope. But and the main issue is when you put a fumigant through the drip tape, it can work well. You have to be very disciplined in getting your system out there at the right time. And you have to make sure it uniformly applies that water or and the fumigant into the bed to get good
So you have to have results. A uniform soil moisture and to a certain depth.
Yeah, it's one of these cases, if you do everything right, it works very well. And if you make a few mistakes, it doesn't do as well as what we call flatbed fumigation.
Okay.
And in that case, for that reason, you see a lot of flatbed fumigation still.
Sure.
They're not using methyl bromide. They use other fumigants.
Right.
That don't work as well as methyl
bromide. Yeah, chloropicton by itself is not a great thing. But
yeah, yeah. So, but they use those same fumigants in the bed fumigations. And another aspect to it is you're not fumigating the furrows. So, well, it's not a big issue for the strawberries, but a lot of these strawberry growers are in rotation with vegetable growers.
Sure.
And the vegetable growers would prefer like not to, to fumigate everything.
Inherit it with the weed seed bank there.
Oh. Yeah.
So is that same drip tape that was put down that might have been used for chemigation, is that left in place then for the irrigation of the life of the crop?
Yes.
Or do they have to replace it? No, they can just
run and then their... after that, usually they fumigate, you know, at least if they do bent fumigation a month or 2 months before they're actually planting.
Right.
And what are they fumigating for? I mean, what is it that's in the ground that they don't want to be there?
Yeah, there's various soil-borne diseases that basically they're infect the root system of those strawberry plants and reduce its productivity. So they grow into the strawberry plant's roots, and then the often they may clog the xylem, you know, the the little pipes in the roots that pull the water. And so the plant eventually dies.
Wow.
Or just killed the plant entirely, depending on where they attack.
Are these a fungus or virus? Or?
Yeah, these are all fungi.
Pythium, Rhizoctonia, Fusarium.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So what about the...
Or molds.
Or molds, yes. Yeah. And then there, the weeds that we talked about also, we're trying to sterilize these seeds prior to them germinating that are in the soil. Is that still the case with the fumigants that are used today?
Yeah, they'll have effects on the weeds too.
Right, right.
Oh, well, and I was wondering why none of those fields had...
Had weeds growing all over it. Then they have mulch.
Because I don't do that in my own backyard.
You don't? No. I'm glad to hear that, Jeff.
Yeah. I don't fumigate.
Well, now I'm certain, too, that the organic growers are not using these chemicals and these methods, and they've got a much more cost valued crop than with the labor involved, but they can still use the irrigation tape. Is flood irrigation still used where they actually flood the furrows? Is that still a process used for any of the crops here locally, or is that just too prohibitive with the water use?
Yeah, I don't see it being used in Santa Cruz County. Now in some areas of Monterey County, especially with a crop like celery, when that crop gets more mature, they may have drip in the field. So they may have started it with sprinklers, switched to drip, but they're 2 or 3 weeks from harvest. And, you know, celery likes water.
Yeah.
And they may have these nice fields that are very lasered leveled. So they'll put an application on a few inches that way. And that celery just flush
A flood treatment then. Yeah, interesting.
So they don't use it exclusively through the crop growing period, but just one or two applications.
And I imagine the soil composition then, you're not going to be dealing with a lot of sand in that kind of a situation because the water wouldn't be able to spread through. It would just percolate out.
Yeah, so the trick with flood is to have the right soil type, the right slope to make it work. And the growers know which fields work really well with flood, but it's used less and less. And we've shown you can grow very nice celery with drip. Where they need flood is often when they get behind in the amount of water they've been applying.
I'm so pleased to hear you talk about celery. We had your fellow UC Extension person, Richard Smith, on a couple of months ago, and I started talking about celery, and he said, I really don't like celery. So we talked about something else. I love celery, and if anyone's wondering, this is KSQD Santa Cruz.
In the garden, folks.
K-Squid, 90.7 FM, and streaming at KSQD.org. We're here with Michael Kahn of the University of California Cooperative Extension, a soil and water farm advisor.
So do you work all 12 months of the year? Is there some kind of project going on all the time?
Well, it's possible to work, you know, in the field 12 months a year here, because I often, and I'm not doing it right now, have winter projects where we're looking at how to prevent runoff from growers' fields. And I'll probably start doing some trials like that next winter. But generally in the wintertime is a slower time because there's not so many crops in the ground.
Right.
And but things are being grown year-round in this area in terms of commercial agriculture.
And you were talking about percentage of your job is still research, right? So you've got various projects going on in different locations. Tell us about that side of your business.
Yeah, so I'm always looking for ideas that we could trial that would help growers be more efficient with either water management or nutrient management, or minimize the impacts of pesticides, you know, on the bay. And so, you know, over the years we've tried all sorts of practices, and you know, trying to get them adopted is another story, but that's the first part. Is okay, you know, we don't necessarily develop it from scratch, the idea. We look at other ideas other people are trying, try it out in our area in grower fields, and that's the beauty of Extension. Is we don't do all our work on a research campus, you know, on a campus with a research farm. We're out in the field, in the growers' fields, partnering with key growers that are interested.
Cooperators,
And a lot of our cooperators then are, I would call them, our first adopters, right?
Right.
And then they take that practice and they try it out.
Yeah, and what kind of scale are we talking about? You take an acre of their land, or they give you an acre to play with, and you're... or is that just like, no, Joe, we only take 10 feet, and that's enough?
No, we want the whole crop, please. We'd like the whole crop.
It can vary. Like on the research, there is a research farm with the USDA ARS. We partner a lot with them, and we'll do our crazy stuff there so we don't impact a grower crop. But once we're pretty sure that that practice works, or that technique works, then we'll bring it out to a commercial field. We might use the whole field or half the field, split it, and compare.
Right.
And you talked about Richard Smith, and we've partnered many times on trials where we're showing growers how to use less nitrogen fertilizer and water. And the grower says, okay, here's a strip of this field, or maybe half the field. And you do your management, I'll do mine, we'll compare. And that is a scary proposition, right?
Mr. Know-all.
Yeah, the value of the crop there.
And Richard, if you're listening, you're a great guy. We love you, even though you don't love celery. Michael, I wanted to go back to some of the technologies again. One of the, there are pros and cons, I'm sure, to every delivery system and technology that's used for water application and irrigation. But one of the things with the drip tape that I had encountered as a grower was the tape is really pretty much one crop. It's a one-trick pony. You use it for one crop. You got to pull that tape, and now you have the byproduct of plastic to dispose of, and it's not a highly recyclable material, at least not at the time that I was growing. Has there been any research done or development in either drip tape that is more readily recyclable or that maybe biodegrades much faster? Anything on that front?
Yeah, actually, there's been a lot of progress. So you mentioned, you know, one-use tape.
Mm-hmm.
So growers quickly realized they wanted to use the tape for multiple crops.
Mm-hmm.
And so they developed a technique where they could splice tape together.
Ah.
And so they had a whole system for extracting the tape out of the field after mm-hmm. the crop was harvested, reeling it up with these hydraulic reels, and then fixing the tape with this splicing machine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they would get maybe 8 or 10 crops out of that single,
oh, wow. That's
that tape.
Way better than where we were at back in the day.
But things have evolved because labor has become so expensive,
yeah.
and doing all that cost a lot.
Mm.
So the drip tape companies came back with single-use tape again, mm-hmm. thinner-walled.
Mm-hmm.
And here the idea is they offered recycling of the tape. And a machine that can reel it in, but not just one bed at a time mm-hmm. or four beds at a time.
Mm-hmm.
You can do 10, 15 beds. It bundles the tape, not on reels, but has a special machine that just puts only the tape together. So there's no other materials. And you can pick up with a crane. These huh? giant bundles.
I've seen them in the fields or at the edge of the
yeah.
fields. Yeah, yeah.
And then they go to a recycling facility and go back into tape or other products.
Oh, well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
That's good to hear. Definitely good to hear. Well, you know, we are going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'd like to talk about some of the applications, the crossover into perhaps our own backyard gardens and talk about your garden a little bit. So we'll be right back. And we're back. This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQD 90.7 FM, and streaming at ksqd.org. This is In the Garden. And we're here with Michael Kahn, farm advisor from University of California Cooperative Extension, Irrigation Water Resource Advisor. Michael, one of the things I'm curious about is with all of the rain and moisture, I think I'm quoting somebody here, but we've had 9 atmospheric rivers, is that correct, just in the last month?
Yeah, I sort of lost count, but it's been a lot.
Yeah.
You know, one right after another every 3 or 4 days.
Right, right.
It looks like we're in a break now.
Yeah, the sun is coming out. But we were talking about aquifers, and I would really like some information about it because I really don't understand what's going on. And you gave us such a good example. Let's share it with the audience.
Yeah, so one way to think of an aquifer is basically it's like a bathtub filled with a material, could be sand, clay, gravel, right, and water. And the water is in the pores between these materials.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we drill a well, it's like a straw going into those materials. And then the well pump is essentially like sucking the water. And the water moves from the pores into your well, right? And the water's not all the way to the top of the bathtub. Mm-hmm. It's halfway, right? Mm-hmm. And you think of your sand material all the way up to the top.
Right.
And so, and then you might have a layer of soil over that. So you have what's called the vadose zone, and that's the area sort of in between the soil and the aquifer. And the aquifer is the part that's saturated with water.
Now, does the guy with the deeper straw get more? Or is it...
Well, that's a good point, you know. And during droughts, people's wells that are shallow mm-hmm. go dry. Mm-hmm. And the person with the more money will drill a new well that's deeper. And mm-hmm. this has been going on in the Central Valley. It's become quite a problem. And so in 2014, the state passed the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act.
I was just going to ask about regulation.
Yeah. And so now every basin, and we call a basin is sort of the bathtub analogy, has to come up with a plan to manage their groundwater sustainably
mm-hmm.
all throughout the state. And this is a pretty historic act. Most states actually have groundwater regulations, but California up to that point said anyone can use the groundwater as long as they're using it beneficially. So now as a community we have to work together to come up with plans mm-hmm. and then implement those plans.
But digging a deeper well and a deeper well and a deeper well, you're eventually going to run out of water anyway, aren't you? I mean,
right. And that's why we have that law now.
One of the issues in my area of Prunedale and my neighbors in Castroville right now is saltwater intrusion. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Right. So these aquifers extend all the way out to the ocean. And the way they keep saltwater not coming into the aquifer is the water level in the aquifer is higher than the ocean level.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a net flow of fresh water out into the ocean. And that keeps that salt water from intruding into the aquifer. But if we pull too much water out of the aquifer and lower it relative to the ocean, then the ocean enters.
Mm.
And once the ocean gets into that aquifer, we say it's salt water intruded, it's contaminated with salt water, mm-hmm. and there's very few examples of moving that salt water back out. And so you essentially have really affected the land on the top, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because now you can't use it for if you don't have irrigation water.
Does okay. the salt water, as it intrudes into the aquifer, does it intermix completely or does it stay at the bottom? I mean, salt water normally, theoretically, would rise to the top.
Is it heavier?
Yeah,
salt water heavier or lighter than?
How does that work?
You know, I'm not a hydrologist. Yeah, couldn't tell you.
That's
exactly.
Why we're asking you.
But essentially, they monitor. You know, it there seems to be some mixing because it doesn't get to the salinity of seawater.
Right.
Right.
So it's not, so it's kind of brackish then.
It's brackish.
Yeah.
It can still, you know, be used.
To a degree.
To a degree. But we monitor or we measure salinity in terms of electrical conductivity units.
Mm-hmm.
And so, say, salt water in the ocean would be 50 or 60 of these units, mm-hmm. maybe in a seawater intruded aquifer, it might be 4 or five.
Okay. Is that parts per million or is that?
Well, I can convert that for you,
yeah.
But
I think
it's a different type of unit. Yeah,
I'm just remembering my little EC meter when I was
getting
close.
So
the reason I asked that question, Michael, is that I had been told by a neighbor that, well, you know, all our neighbors, they got deeper wells than us. They're going to get that salt water first. Ha ha. Our well's half the depth. Well, we're going to run out of water before they do, but maybe they'll get salt water first. I don't know.
Yeah, a lot of it depends on the aquifer. So in the Salinas Valley, the deeper aquifer has less salt water intrusion.
Okay.
Yeah, because that water, we would call it under pressure, because there's clay layers on top of the aquifer that keep that water actually pressurized.
So it's true, Salinas Valley has two aquifers, one above the other?
In close to the coast.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where you have those clay layers.
Mm-hmm.
But we've recently learned that salt water that has intruded in the upper aquifer has moved down into some of the lower aquifers, and that's scary. And so these patches of saltwater intrusion have sort of jumped ahead close to the city of Salinas.
Well, I'm also interested, I think that our audience would like to know about the situation with the San Andreas Fault and the Pajaro River. I thought you said that was pretty interesting.
That's a good point. The geology can affect these aquifers too, like the San Andreas Fault going across 129, where Aromas is.
Mm-hmm.
And so it geologically separates the upper and lower Pajaro. And so that's a challenge for the Pajaro Basin in the Watsonville area, because all that water that infiltrates in the upper Pajaro into the aquifer is not available for the lower Pajaro, because it's like a dam, the San Andreas Fault. Oh.
It's, we're talking granite running against granite, so it's...
Yeah, or rock. Or I'm not sure what...
Non-porous.
Geology, yeah.
Yeah.
And so the challenge is you have very little distance to take all this rain that we got and infiltrate it into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like 10 or 15 miles
right.
or less. And actually not all that ground is... has good continuity to the aquifer.
Mm-hmm.
So you have clay layers close to the coast that, you know, the water basically hits a ground, a water table, a clay layer, and doesn't infiltrate anymore.
Yeah.
So it's a very narrow zone for doing all this infiltration.
So the infiltration rates, I know it's going to vary by the soil composition, the types of soils, but on average, the rainfall that we get that, after field saturation, it's all running off to the ocean or something, but how long does it take for the aquifer to be replenished by that groundwater? I know, again, you just said infiltration rates vary, but on average, is it like the rain we get in winter will hit the aquifer in summer or fall, or how long would you say?
Yeah, usually by, we'll look at the aquifer levels, the royal we, right, the agencies that manage the water, and they're always monitoring with their wells, and they'll see it's at its low point in, say, October or so. And then by the spring, after the rains, you'll see it's shot back up. It's pretty amazing.
And is that from that spring's rains or from the previous?
No, from that winter,
okay.
that winter rain.
Okay. Yeah.
So it doesn't take, like, years for this water to infiltrate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually because we have some really nice percolation areas, in the valleys.
Yeah. Well, we're running out of time here, and I want Michael to talk a little bit about what he does in his own backyard.
That's right.
And the kinds of things that you grow, and what advice as, an expert in your field would you give home gardeners? And we're talking about people who have, pretty good-sized vegetable gardens in the back. What would you advise them?
Well, a challenge I had, being in this area, I'm in the Aptos here. That's where I live. We have very high water prices.
Yeah.
And so I'm always weighing, is it worth the cost of the water to grow these vegetables?
Yeah.
So I try to use the water as efficiently as possible.
Uh-huh.
And I do use drip tape in my garden.
You do?
Yeah. It works very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
So
you just hook a hose up to your system and it's reduced pressure and then through the drip, or do you have something fancier than that?
I have a place where the water comes out. I basically converted where I had a sprinkler riser
okay.
and put on a pressure regulator,
uh-huh.
you know, and it's an automated valve that so it can come on. And then I have like what they call a header and then yeah. these drip lines for each of the rows.
What sorts of things are you growing?
Well, what I like to grow now is asparagus.
No kidding.
Yeah, because I was thinking, well.
Perennial crop. And
yeah, it's pretty easy. And I like asparagus in the spring, and you get it for quite a while. So I
just keep harvesting. It keeps coming.
It keeps coming. Yeah. So if you like asparagus, that's it. That's a nice, easy crop to grow.
Every 2 or 3 years, lift the crowns and separate them and plant them out some more. Yeah. Nice. Well, I have to ask you the perennial question that all our new guests get. What is, as a child, your earliest memory of plants or gardens in general?
Well, probably earliest memory is just being a little kid back in Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
And in those days, you know, parents didn't watch where their kids went. They just said, get out the door and come back at dark.
Yes.
So I used to wander down the street into this wooded area and just have lots of fun making forts and climbing trees with my friends and make, you know, falling in the swamp, you know. So we were outdoors all the time.
So you started making mud pies early. You
didn't Pretty
to,
early.
You didn't have to go to college for
that. Yeah, yeah. So it's just a continuum of my early childhood.
That's great.
How technical are you getting? I interviewed a wine grape grower from down in Greenfield, and he was telling me they use satellites now. Would you explain some of what they use a satellite for?
Yeah, so another aspect of my work is figuring out better ways to determine how much water a crop needs.
Mm-hmm.
And we use weather information to do that, as particularly evapotranspiration calculations. They're based on relative humidity measurements, wind speed, solar radiation, air temperature, and there's an equation to turn that into an estimate of how much water a well-watered, I would say, full canopy crop would use. And our reference crop usually is grass, well-watered grass.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of satellite products that are trying to do the same thing because they can measure solar radiation also, or net radiation we call. Net is what's absorbed minus what's reflected back into space.
Right.
And so that's helping our estimates of plant water use. We can also use satellites to estimate the canopy cover of the crop. So when it's small, it doesn't have much canopy, it doesn't need much water. As it gets bigger, it's more canopy, it needs more water. And so there's becoming more products available, satellite products to help growers.
Yeah, I mean, the fellow that was telling me was saying, I know what part of my vineyard needs more water. And what part doesn't. And I get it on a daily basis.
Well, yeah, so one of the things they will see is if it's water stressed, the canopy doesn't grow as well.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can get a heat signal, a thermal signal from the satellites. Or sometimes they don't use satellites, they use airplanes.
Well, back to the home gardener again. I remember back in the day we had these devices that we would stick into the soil, and it was something to do with water tension soil or something to tell you. And they were available for the home gardener as well. Are those still in play? And what are those called? Hydrometers or something? What's a hydrometer?
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is something that has that's essentially measuring electrical conductivity.
Oh, okay.
So if it's wet around it,
it's picking it up.
It you conduct more electricity, and it says it's wet. So it's probably two electrodes on that meter. Those are basically good to tell you it's wet or dry.
So it's like stick your finger in the soil, dummy. You can get the same results.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
So something that would be a little better is called a tensiometer.
Tensiometer.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That has a ceramic cup.
That's what I was referring
to. That lets water move in and out, and it also has a vacuum gauge. And so what happens is if the soil is dry, the water moves out of that ceramic mm-hmm. cup, gets into sort of an equilibrium with the soil tension, and creates a vacuum pressure because air can't get into the tensiometer.
Oh, yeah.
And so you read that vacuum pressure. So the higher it is, the drier the soil.
Yeah. Now, if in orchards, aren't there emitters that can tell whether the walnut or almond needs more, or the apple needs more water or less, and we'll turn it on and turn off the water? Does that technology exist?
There's been some attempts to create something like that mm-hmm. for irrigation, but I haven't seen anything available. In orchards, they do use drip mm-hmm. emitters,
mm-hmm.
And you can use those in your garden also. They use micro sprinklers.
Right.
Yeah. But there's not a lot of, basically they'll irrigate the entire orchard in a similar manner.
So each little tree would get a little bit of water? Is that how
right.
it would work?
They won't water the middles, but around the tree.
So yeah, water conservation is still a paramount aspect of everything you're working on, everything that we homeowners should be conscious of as well then.
Right.
It's a limited resource, even though we shouldn't be fooled by the recent rains and how wonderful it is. The climate is changing. We are still in a drought. Is that not correct?
Yeah. I mean, although we got a lot of rain,
yeah.
a huge percentage went in the ocean.
Yeah.
So it's what counts is what gets into the ground.
Yeah.
In terms of our water status.
Yeah. I looked at the numbers for some of the reservoirs, and they're just about half full. And like Lake San Antonio or something, it's 37% of capacity, even after the storm.
Mm. Yeah. But Nacimiento is at 90% or more.
Wow. Yeah.
And they've had to release the water.
Oh.
Yeah. So San Antonio doesn't get as much water or mm-hmm. much runoff as Nacimiento.
Yeah.
And so there is plans, hopefully, to build a tunnel to take water out of Nacimiento and into San Antonio in the future.
Nacimiento is a little higher than San Antonio?
It
must be if they're going to build a tunnel through, right?
Yeah, or they'll make it.
They'll find a point where
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just the runoff area is different for San Antonio than Nacimiento. Nacimiento just always gets more runoff and
yeah.
fills up faster, and then they have to release it.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Nacimiento Canal.
And those are definitely rain water is the source, but San Luis Reservoir is different, right?
Right. So San Luis is filled from the Central Valley Canal.
Right.
And it's sort of a holding place.
It's just like a big cistern.
They yeah.
pump it all up there.
Pump it in there.
Yeah.
And some of that water can go to San Benito County when there's enough water available.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But essentially, our Central Coast, we have no water transfers from the Central Valley. So everything that's in our ground here is what we get.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's...
So.
Well, I tell you what, I'm sure happy that I've had enough rain at my place and that I'm still wet and soaked. I hope that the growers throughout the Salinas Valley and Santa Cruz will be able to get a little bit of a break in terms of their irrigation needs going forward, at least in the first couple of months of the season. With all the rain that we've had before they have to, well, they'll always have to pump a certain amount or apply a certain amount.
Yeah. And in the last 2 minutes that we have, what about those areas that are farmed that got flooded, where the Salinas River went all over Spreckles? Does that ruin the soil, or is that good for the soil? Or,
well, we have to see. You know, so some of these farms really got inundated. And it made a mess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had crops in the ground. They were ruined. Or there was plans to plant.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're growing fresh market leafy greens, you pretty much have to wait almost 60 days after the flooding to just be sure that we are following all the food safety protocols.
So that that's pathogen-free, is that what we're looking
at?
Yeah,
and do soil testing, looking for E. coli, salmonella.
Right.
So we want to be sure that these fields are safe before they're planted.
But that's going to delay planting, and it's a setback.
Yes, and there's probably, moving a field's planting into different ranches, trading with other growers maybe.
Mm. Yeah.
The early crops.
Are you and the Ag Extension Office responsible for testing whether or not soil is contaminated, or because it's running off now from cities. Now, admittedly, the cities are small on the Salinas River Valley area, but it's still runoff. So there's petroleum and gunk and who knows what else in the storm sewers.
Yeah, in the Salinas River, it may have gotten municipal waste. Sewage plants that got in there. So it's up to the growers, really, to send those soil samples in to a commercial lab for testing.
But San Lorenzo, for instance, up here, that's mostly rural, mostly forest, right? So it's probably a little cleaner than certainly heavily populated areas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you're living downstream, yeah. Well, I
have one announcement. Oh, I'm going to be at San Lorenzo Nursery in 35 minutes. I am giving a demonstration on how to prune your roses, and you are welcome to join us anytime in the future, too.
Yes.
Michael, thank you so much.
Michael, thank you for coming in. Agriculture is the backbone of our economy here in the Tri-County area, and our farmers who are resilient are still fortunate to have you helping them through all rain and shine. So thank you so much again for coming on. Much pleasure to have you here today, sir.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.